Talk given Friday, 28th of October, 1977. I wonder how much each one of us really appreciates the importance of the actual living of the life. The living of the religious life, which is also the living of the life of the yogi, of the mystic, of the contemplative, use what term you like. I wonder how many of us do understand what is implied in living the religious life. The first and foremost implication of the living of the religious life is the complete turning away from all worldliness. Which means fundamentally being so watchful with regard to our everyday life that we discover from moment to moment every expression of self-orientedness, self-concern and self-centeredness. It is by no means an easy task. This self-orientedness is something which we inherit through natural evolution. And this natural evolutionary process has gone on for millions of years. And therefore the power of this natural self-orientedness for the preservation of one's own organism and the perpetuation of the species and the pleasure drive involved in it all is a titanic force. To be awake to the manifestation of this self-centeredness and this pleasure drive and the desire for what we commonly call security. It's so powerful that it is extremely difficult to be watchful enough to catch oneself all the time living self-orientedly. Now the important point there is to be as fully awake as possible to the nature of our consciousness, the nature of our awareness from moment to moment. Whatever we think, feel, say, do, whatever mood we are in, whatever activity we are engaged in, is the expression of our inner mode of awareness. Is it self-centered? Is it directed towards obtaining something for the pleasure of the self, the security of the self? And security means all too often the retreat from life and life's difficulties. not facing up to the fact as the fact. We are really incapable of it. If we were capable of it, our problems and difficulties would just fall off. Our misbehavior in the religious sense would never occur. We would never have to suppress or repress our peccadilloes in the mind, our unmoral state psychologically and so forth. We would never have to suppress it or repress it. If the intensity of awareness were there, that finishes that state. This doesn't mean that it will never arise again. Because even if one's own psyche is purified, there is this worldwide flood of ill psychical influence playing upon us all the time. We live in this ocean of the psychical influence. And our psyche must not fight against it. We tend to fight against it, to want to push it aside, because our own psyche gets caught up and hurt and besmirched in the process, and we don't want it, we don't like it. But that is not the way to approach it. The way to approach it is this intensity of awareness that this is what is happening. Not even to say beware of it. This is what is happening. Right. The intensity of awareness purifies the influence of this psychical atmosphere which has actually entered, found lodgment in your psyche. A demon has managed to get into your house of God. You see, it's like that. We have to watch our behavior, absolutely watch it. And remember the Buddha's words particularly in this connection. One has to see peril in the slightest failure in connection with the senses and the pleasure drive. Because the pleasure drive, of course, has its antagonist, the displeasure state. But the pleasure drive does not know, does not acknowledge, and always refuses to acknowledge that it itself is the progenitor of the displeasure state. Because insofar as we are the slaves of this pleasure drive, we do not see that being the psyche being in its ambivalent state yet inevitably raises up the displeasure consequence whenever the pleasure drive is operating. So you see, we are hypocritical with ourselves. We are untrue to what we imagine that we really care for or are concerned with, the living of the religious life. This is not intended as an uncompassionate or schoolmasterish condemnation of ourselves. We are all in it. So, what happens is that being insufficiently awake to this innermost mode of activity, this mode of awareness of existence, being not really awake to what it actually is, we like to have stimuli to exalt us emotionally with sublime ideas and wonderful emotions. They may be quite peaceful and quiet, but they are all in the realm of the dual. And they are all perishable. They are all signs of an inner reality. They are not the inner reality. We don't see that. So we gaily go on in the name of, oh, being sociable or being friendly or this, that and the other. Not at all. That is not the thing. We like to feel that we are seriously concerned with this living of the religious life, seriously concerned with yoga or whatever it is. But really look within. And you see, the eyes always look outwards. And the psychical eyes do just the same. They look outwards, away from ourselves. Because it's rather terrifying, rather horrible to look into our own soul. So, we don't look within ourselves. And if we make the attempt to look within ourselves, we make the attempt in the spirit of the devil. Meaning, something for ourselves. You see, this is the most difficult thing to deal with. This self-orientedness, which isolates us from truth, from the actuality. So we like to sort of learn things, study things, meet together in order to be uplifted or enter into deep modes of awareness which are blissful or whatever it is. You see, we live psychologically and at what we might call a spiritual level, somewhat like the man who says, oh well, another little drink wouldn't do us any harm. Just another little drink. Or St. Augustine's famous statement, make me chaste, O God, but not just yet. Now you see, this simply won't do. That doesn't mean stop studying, stop meeting. That is just spinelessness, giving up the ghost. We may like to and try to give up the ghost, and goodness knows, we do it sufficiently 1,000 times every day. But the ghost won't give us up. Don't forget that. You can't get away from this ghost. See, that's why he is called the Holy Ghost. Why the Holy Ghost? Because this ghost is whole, complete, holy, and is the creative power which never ceases to influence us whatsoever we do. It is there. Underneath are the everlasting arms. And the everlasting arms are not there merely to mollycoddle us. The arm of the Lord strikes also in punishment. This is one of the wonderful teachings of the Kabbalah. You know, when the Kabbalah presents the whole reality symbolically in terms of the figure of a man, the right shoulder represents infinite mercy, and the left shoulder and arm represents stern judgment and punishment. But you see, each one of us has both arms. And the animating life throughout the whole body, throughout the whole being, you and I, the individual being, as well as the total being, which is Yahweh Elohim. We have both arms, and they operate together. So the ghost doesn't leave us alone. The hound of heaven always holds us within his jaws. We can prevent this hound of heaven from laying our whole being on the altar as the complete and total sacrifice, the total giving of self to the supreme reality. We can obstruct the hound of heaven from doing that. The hound of heaven loses with the majority of human beings in the globe. It's the dogs of Yama, the lord of death, those two terrible dogs. I'm not sure, but I think partly symbolized also in Cerberus with the Greek teachings. It is those two hounds who come to fetch the sinner, to take him to hell and punish him. It is those two dogs which dog our footsteps through our life. You know, Krishnamurti, for instance, has emphasized the necessity for the serious mind. As well as the religiously inclined mind. We have to be serious about this. We don't know the meaning of the word serious in this context. This is why people like ourselves who seek, there is that aspect in us which strongly seeks the reality, the truth, and so forth. That is why people like us suffer more intensely as the result of our wrongdoing, our failures, and so forth, than the ordinary man of the world. You see, some profound sensitivity gets more awakened in us and operates within us because of our longing for the truth, God, whatever you like. It operates in us, makes the whole psychophysical organism far more sensitive. And these dormant, extremely powerful, subtle energies come into play. And as you know, any subtle energy is far more powerful than an energy which is more concrete and not so subtle. The constant drop, drop by drop, drop by drop, wears away the hardest stone. Now, water is far more subtle, not so concrete as solid stone. And air, which is much more subtle than water, just blows and the water evaporates away. Get to subtler and subtler stages and you get to profounder and profounder degrees of power to bring about consequences that we do not foresee and cannot foresee. This is what happens in our innards. Every bit of knowledge that we gather together by conversing, by considering together, awakens these energies. It is said in India, for it has been said through the centuries in India, that in the master-pupil, master-disciple relationship, the teacher has to accept the karma of the pupil's failures. He is responsible for that. When we converse together, even ordinary chit-chat, we have to be extremely careful, extremely circumspect. One never knows the consequences. Look at this topical instance at present. Mr. Thorpe and Mr. Scott. Oh, I beg your pardon. No, not that. That man who at the dinner party used words which are used colloquially amongst people, you see, carelessly, without any intention to harm, although those words may express a certain degree of superior condescension and contempt for the lesser breeds of men and all that nonsense, you see. One man said it, and look at the consequence to him, because another man reported it, gave it away. There is no such thing as a secret which is entirely secret to ourselves in our life. Why? How? This silent watcher inside our own being. Way back in the Rig Veda, you had the god Varuna, who knows all about every single thought and feeling and word and act that we go through. And he's the dispenser of justice. And the other gods assist him. Way back in the Rig Veda this was taught. This, which has been called the silent watcher. I have put it in these terms, that every single thought, feeling, etc., makes an impress upon the brain and the whole organism, which you can never escape. That is why no man can escape his karma. It's not that somebody else necessarily comes into the story, pronounces a sentence, and other bodies come along and act as your jailers or warders or punishers or whatever it is. It's I myself who have decreed this in my own being. That's why the Buddha emphasized this absolute watchfulness so very much. Now, if we are concerned with the religious life, this is the first and foremost thing. This unceasing mindfulness. When we are looking at TV, enjoying a pleasant film, or being thrilled from the top of our heads to the bottom of our feet with the horror that is going on, or having the suppressed lusts within us satisfied by seeing sexuality and violence and God knows what not going on. See, when all that is going on, supposing we are sitting there looking on like that, be fully aware of what is going on in one's own psyche, one's own brain, one's own feelings and thoughts, the gratifications we surreptitiously enjoy at what we have lusted after and not found in our lives. Or if we have found it and enjoyed wonderful occasions when, oh, it was just heavenly and all the rest of that devilish nonsense, you see, that memory comes up again. Every memory is a scar upon the psyche, apart from just the purely technological skills and the know-hows of how to cook a dish or wash the baby clean and all that kind of thing. See, apart from that, now, if we stir up subtle energies, and this is especially what happens with those who practice disciplines as laid down, whether it be the yogic discipline or this or that system of meditation, Zen or Theravada or the Christian mystics' methods, the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola and the whole lot, you see. And in the Kabbalah there are similar disciplines. Abraham Abu Lafia, the contemporary of Moses de Leon, if you read his writings you will see talking about nothing but yoga and the yogic discipline including pranayama and all the rest of it, you see. If we practice these disciplines, we make the situation more and more difficult for us. Now, you see, look, there is that situation in life, it occurs again and again, when to be really critical of ourselves, stern with ourselves, critical and stern without being cruel, without being violent upon ourselves. This is the important point to remember. Because besides Gabura, there is also Hesed, infinite mercy at work, mediated by Rahamim, compassion in its reality at the heart center. or if you like to use the Sanskrit term, you have anahata. You see? And so forth. Without being cruel to ourselves. You see, this is important. But really to be stern and critical and see with X-ray eyes the whole fact without reacting for or against it. Then these subtle forces, these very subtle, very powerful energies will do you no harm. Nor expect them to do any good. Why do I say that? No harm, I know. But good? What is the real good? That I still don't know. When the psyche is utterly cleansed, and therefore mind in its transcendent reality is completely at one with your psyche, because it's empty, it's transparent. When that is the situation, the brain is purely an instrument of observation, and all its, that is the brain's, knowing process, and therefore tabulating and systematizing and putting in the right pigeonhole has all vanished, then you yourself are the real good. Then there's nothing to know about. It just functions by itself. And it is the totality, it is transcendence functioning through you unhindered. You see, the great gods of the Rig Veda, the great gods of the pantheons of the world, are the representatives on the macrocosmic scale of all these pure energies. Now you see, this is the real nature of meditation. This is the meditative state. The truly meditative state is one in which you have gone completely outside the realm of all systematic laid down meditations. They are musings, if you like. They are verbal rituals, if you like, which can be helpful, provided you remember the words of the Buddha, it is not so, it is not so, it is not so. The words of Yajnavalkya, the Atma is not this, it's not this, it is not this. So the brain never knows. If you ever come to the stairs situation where you say, oh yes, I know what happens there, then your knowledge as such is just a very limited thing. And because of its limitation, there is, in some degree or other, a deceptive, seductive element in it. See why? You see why? I have attained this stage. There is no attainment. And just, now this, even ordinary imagination can show you. Supposing you are the totality, God the totality. What is there to attain or to achieve? You are the totality. There is nothing to attain now. Nothing to nothing to achieve. It is as simple as that. What brings about the ideas of attainment, achievement, and so forth? The idea of a self, I, as separate, as different from the outside. He who doth crush the great conceit, I am, he is the one who is in the state of true happiness. You read the Mahavagga, the opening pages. This is one of the things the Buddha says on the night of the enlightenment. One of the wonderful things he says. Now you see, the translation goes, he who doth crush the great conceit, I am. The translation, yes, it's a linguistically correct translation. But neither the Pali nor the translation does anything but mislead you. Crush the great conceit, I am. Supposing it was put this way, and remember that no one heard the words of the Buddha on the night of the enlightenment, he was alone. This was produced afterwards, centuries afterwards it was written down, 2-3 centuries after his death. So of course, less intelligent people couldn't help putting this. This is not to condemn them, this is how it happens. So we have to accept, but it is for you and me to penetrate into the reality, the truth of it. He who is fully awake to this misconcept, this mere idea, I am, separating this I am from the total I am, he who is free of that, then there is true happiness. And that happiness is not the absence of pain and the presence of pleasure, not the elimination of sorrow and the manufacturing of joy, nothing of the sort. Its dimension is altogether transcendent. If you prick me with a pin, suddenly I shall certainly feel pain. You do that to an elephant or a rhinoceros, he won't know at all that you've done anything. You can caress me and I'll feel a very pleasurable sensation over my skin. Do it to a rhinoceros. He'll feel nothing. You see the kind of understanding of these things that is needed. Not just an intellectual grasp of it. That's the first step, of course. The intellect sees it. The pattern of words, which has a certain meaning for you, in terms of actual living experience through the senses. The instance I gave was the sense of touch, the pin or the caress. So we start that way. But starting that way, we must realize this is just the very beginning. Let the inner awareness awaken all the time with it. This is the fact. This is the nature of the fact. Then that state where, as the Buddha says, you are one not liable to delusion comes into being. Now, this is all tied up with the release of the meditative state. And this means that you are meditating. That is to say, you are obstructing less and less the one and only meditator from meditating. Transcendence is the meditator. Transcendence meditating is man perfected, the Holy One, the Enlightened One, the Prince of Peace and the Lord of Love, the completely empty and purified psyche. Transcendence meditating is man. In my chapter on the Upanishads, you see, this is not original to me. The formulation perhaps is in the English language, but it is there in the old teachings if you wake up to it and discover it. I've put it in the Heart of Religion in that chapter on the Upanishads. Man is transcendence thinking. In Genesis and in the Trismegistic teachings of Hermes, which is the Hellenized form of the Greek teachings, and Elohim minded, let us make man in our own image, in our own likeness. I wish I had left out the word image in the book and put likeness there. That would have been less misleading. But it didn't strike me until quite recently. Supposing we put it this way, and Elohim minded, let us make man in our own living likeness. Now, nature, which contains the whole range of all the different grades of manifestation of the one primordial energy, at its concretest level, produced what you and I are aware of as solids, liquids, gases, trees, living organisms, you see, animals, creatures, men, as you and I see them. Nature did that. But Elohim, this energy at work, didn't make a man as a sculptor makes a bust or a whatever it is, a statue, you see. Didn't do that. This energy at its own divine level, its transcendent level, functioning as the releaser of manifestation out of the undifferentiated, unmanifest, released this thing which you and I call man at its concretest level. You get it? Well, it doesn't matter if you don't, because it's on the record anyway. You see? So, transcendence meditating is mind, actually, is man. The two words are interchangeable. Man, we can call the son of mind. Mind, at its transcendent level, is this one primordial energy in action. releasing the totality of cosmos, not merely the galaxies and stars and everything that you and I see and can measure and touch and all that, not merely that. This is a tiny fragment of the totality in the mind of God, if you like to use that phrase. All the words I say, all the words anybody has said through the ages, they are all poor things compared with when you sort of awaken to this suddenly, it doesn't knock you over. You don't feel, oh, you could have knocked me down with a feather. You can't. Because in this sort of awakening or enlightenment or realization or whatever you like to call it, there is complete peace. In those moments, there is no self there. There is no psychical activity, no brain activity there. It just is there as a fact. And that kind of fact is totally different from our ordinary everyday dictionary meaning of the word fact. Our dictionary meaning is something which is made. It's from the Latin facio, facere, faci, factu. That is all. Something which is made. That's the fact. But this fact is quite a different thing. It's not at a transcendent level different from our level, but it's the level, it's the totality. So now you see, what is meditation? This meditative state of Elohim, of God, is the unceasingly creative state. Releasing cosmos into being, taking cosmos simultaneously back into the state of chaos in its primordial meaning, not in the meaning of disorder. What you and I call order and disorder are both contained within the divine order. You see, the gods come and go. Hindu teaching is extraordinary there. Brahma has a life. One of his days is the equal of our, now this is where the Hindus were very amusing and delightful, 4,320 million years. Our human is one day of Brahma. Brahma lives 100 years and then he disappears into pralaya, the state of Sabbath, rest. He's done his job. And he's given his pension by Vishnu. And 100 years of Brahma, you see, are equivalent to one day of Vishnu. Vishnu has 100 years and he goes off to have his pension. And then comes Shiva on the scene. And again, 100 years. It's convenient to put in nothings, you know. It looks lovely and big and wonderful, you see. People get a marvelous, exciting feeling inside their physical hearts. The heart does go faster and faster. You see. So the gods come and the gods go. What insight? What insight into the nature of totality, of transcendence, to give this symbolic form. Some people might say, oh, horribly inartistic, so exaggerated, so out of proportion. Well, of course it is out of proportion for little minds.
isn't it?
Similarly, all the devils and the demons come and go. But whence do they come and whence do they go, if you like to ask the question? There is no destruction in the sense, there is no death in the sense of annihilation for any of these. Because Brahma comes again, Vishnu comes again, Shiva comes again, and the ring dance of creation goes on and on and on and on. And what is the nature of creation? Not just making something. Because even you and I can sense occasionally in our most lucid moments the simultaneity of the making and the breaking up at the same time. This death, other life pulse, this terrific mystery, what the Kabbalah call the life-death pulse. And as a matter of fact, the life-death pulse is also used in the writings in India and so forth. But I have always preferred to call it life, other life, simply because the word death in the hinterland of our minds is associated with annihilation. There is no such thing as annihilation. You see? Now, if the intellect can sort of calmly appreciate, really appreciate and respond in the right manner to this kind of knowledge, don't take my words for it. I mean, use any words you like, you see, or from any religious text you like. If the intellect can respond to it like in the right way, you'll find yourself inwardly very peaceful and quiet. And as time goes on, you will see deeper and deeper into the fact, the nature, the functioning, which, for which I have used this phrase, creative action in eternity. Once you really sort of breathe that mountain air, you will stop meditating in order to produce this result or that result. Or thinking, ah, this is living the religious life. It's transcendence alone which lives the religious life. We are all the still photographs of little bits of that religious life. And this is what we run after. We see one photograph which appeals to us and says, ah, that's it, at last I found the truth. So you rush off to Japan and become a Zen monk. Or you rush off to the Red Indians in, or whatever they are in, the forests of the Amazon and find some strange sounding God's name which you worship and so forth. Or if it is overmuch for you, you take to the whiskey bottle. Well, a real instance occurred at the Buddhist summer school. Temporarily. You see? Be careful. Be careful. There is peril all along the line. But if you really know peril, or really awake to it, the peril which is like stepping over the edge of the precipice, if you are really awake to it, you will reverse gravity and you will step over the precipice quite safely. you will step into the void in which there is no falling or rising, because there is no separative I consciousness in it. Then all demand for security, for just a little bit of love, for just a little bit of friendship, I'm so lonely and this and that, all that sad nonsense just disappears. And you wake up to the very refreshing, supremely energizing fact, no one can teach me to meditate, no one can help me. And you get established, not in your pride and conceit, but in your true aloneness. He who is alone is one only. Transcendence, the totality, is one only. But hearing things like this, merely accepting them, is not at all enough. That is to say, merely accepting them with the brain. Because the brain is the repository of 1,001 conflicting elements. And it constantly casts its shadow over the psyche. No, it is not so, it is not so, it is not so. Then, in terms of action, the living, the putting into practice of this knowledge, which is at this level, just at the intellectual level, remember the words of the Buddha? Na me so apta. This is not the reality, the truth, the actuality of me. This is not so. Therefore, let it pass away. Whether it be something which is of the body, the senses, whether it be feelings, whether it be thoughts, ideas, perceptions, mental patterns, or the deep states of consciousness. Every one of them, put it aside. That is to say, you don't push it away from you. Do remember that. This is another misfortune with regard to words and translations. You don't push it aside. You just let it be and you really understand it. There is this mystery of transcendent understanding, which is the enlightened state, and which is free of the restrictions imposed by brain, by knowledge, by ideas, which are all fixations, bondages. They are not the supreme spiritual freedom. What did the Buddha say? The goal of the Brahmafaring is unshakable freedom of mind. And there's no such thing as my mind or your mind. My psyche, your psyche, yes. But those are just limiting things. Those are things which are bound within the circle of mortality. Unshakable freedom of mind. What did the Buddha realize and how? In that utter purification of the psyche, made like a palm, the stump of a palm tree, never to sprout up again. How wonderful are these deep teachings. We read all these things and we say, we know Buddhism. Do we? Challenge it. All along the line. challenge it all along the line, till you come to the blessed, the condition, that beatitude, which says, which enables you to know, I do not know. You see? So, unshakable freedom of mind, this one and only mind, that aspect of creative energy, whose action in eternity releases cosmos. See why the Buddha said, the Dhamma, the truth, the teaching, or if you like to use that word, the doctrine, which in its original meaning is that which teaches. You see? Is lovely in its beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely in the end. It is loveliness itself. And you know, you find, I'm sorry, I can't quote the exact words and chapter and verse, you find the identical teaching in the Upanishads. So now, watch. The words of Jesus, watch and pray, for you know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Mind, the Son of Man, cometh. And the Son of Mind means the redeeming power of pure mind, as and when the purified psyche within yourself allows this divine influence to function freely through you, and you are then man.